Welcome to the Ithaca Radio Hour, a weekly program of news, views, culture, and events in our area. I'm your host, John Illingworth. Today is Monday, April 7th, 2003. Tonight we present an interview with and music from singer-songwriter Kathy Moser on her visit to Ithaca to help build a straw bale home last week. A talk by Citigroup CEO Sandy Weil and his response to criticism from the Rainforest Action Network, and Marty Luster with commentary about the governor's role in formulating the state budget. But first, we'll hear excerpts from Arun Gandhi's speech last month at Cornell. In March, Arun Gandhi, grandson of Mohandas Gandhi and director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, spoke at Cornell University's Statler Auditorium. The following are excerpts from that piece entitled Lessons from My Grandfather.
I also learned from him a very profound lesson in understanding nonviolence by first understanding violence itself. And this happened one day when I was coming back from my school, and I had a notebook and a little pencil in my hand, and I was walking home, and absentmindedly I just happened to look at that pencil. It was about 3 inches long. And I said to myself, I deserve a better pencil. This is too small for anybody to use. And without a second thought, I just threw that pencil away because I was so sure that Grandfather would give me a new pencil when I asked him for one. But that evening when I went and asked Grandfather for a new pencil, instead of giving me one, he subjected me to a lot of questions. He wanted to know how the pencil became small and where did I throw it away and why did I throw it away and on and on and on. And I couldn't understand why he was making such a fuss over a little pencil until he told me to go out and look for it. And I said, you must be kidding. He said, you don't expect me to look for this little pencil in the dark? He said, oh yes, I do. He has a flashlight. He gave me a flashlight and sent me out to look for this pencil, and I must have spent about 2 hours searching for it. And when I finally found it and brought it to him, he said, now I want you to sit here and learn two very important lessons. The first lesson is that even in the making of a simple thing like a pencil, we use a lot of the world's natural resources. And when we throw them away, we are throwing away the world's natural resources, and that is violence against nature. The second lesson is that because in an affluent society we can afford to buy all these things in bulk, we overconsume the resources of the world, and because we overconsume them, we are depriving people elsewhere of these resources, and they have to live in poverty, and that is violence against humanity. And that was the first time I realized that all these little things that we do every day, consciously and unconsciously, all the things that we throw away and waste because we have such a lot of it, we don't know what to do, that every time we are doing that, we are committing an act of violence, either against nature or against humanity. So in that sense, we are all violent. And we need to understand and acknowledge that. Now, physical violence is something we understand because it's all the kinds of violence where we use physical force against one another. But passive violence is something that we can very easily ignore because it's a type of violence where we don't use any physical force. We sometimes don't even know that we are committing violence. And the connection between the two, Grandfather explained to me, is that we commit passive violence all the time, every day, consciously and unconsciously against people. And that generates anger in the victim, and the victim then explodes into physical violence. Now coming back to what happens today and relating what I just said to what is happening today in the world, it's because of all the passive violence that we have been committing over the years that has generated so much anger in the people all over the world there. And that's why we are now becoming victims of violence. After 9/11 happened, a lot of people asked me questions about how would your grandfather deal with this situation. And they still keep on asking me that question. And I told them, I said, I feel that grandfather would have done two things. First thing, after 9/11, instead of seeking revenge, he would have done some introspection to try to find out why people around the world hate us so much as to want to do such harm to us. And then try to improve our relationships with the rest of the world so that we can live happily together and work for each other. And in the short term, to contain the activities of the terrorists, he would have gone to the United Nations and invited all the people of the world, all the countries of the world, to join and unitedly fight terrorism in the world. By unilaterally declaring war on terrorism, we are fighting an unknown enemy. We don't know who the terrorists are. We assume that all the Muslims are terrorists, or all the Arabs are terrorists. We assume that all Afghanistan people were terrorists, and so we went and bombed Afghanistan and killed people there. And now we are going to do the same thing with Iraq. Just to get rid of Saddam Hussein, we are going to kill people because they are all dispensable. That's going to make people hate us more, and more terrorism against us, and so it'll reach a point when we will not be able to step out of the boundaries of our country and go anywhere in the world, because nobody will want to entertain us. So it is passive violence that fuels the fire of physical violence. So logically, if we want to put out the fire of physical violence, we have to cut off the fuel supply. And the fuel supply comes from each one of us. So unless we become the change that we wish to see in the world, unless we acknowledge the violence that exists within us and all the things that we do every day, then we will not be able to bring about peace in this world.
You've just heard Arun Gandhi speaking at Cornell last month. Thanks to Rick Wood for that recording. You're listening to the Ithaca Radio Hour.
I'm Kathy Moser. I'm a songwriter and a singer from New Jersey.
Last week, Kathy Moser traveled to Ithaca to help construct a straw bale house at Eco Village. Emily Shumway interviewed her there in the common room.
What brings you to Ithaca right now?
I came up to Ithaca to help build a straw bale house at the Eco Village. And while I was here, I wanted to play some music. And I was lucky enough to connect with some other venues up here.
What got you started in music and songwriting and such?
When I was about 10, my parents got divorced. I started playing around that time, and then there was like a pretty wild, disrupted family time. I would just go to my room when things got crazy in the house and play guitar. And it was just like the main thing that was a consistent form of solace and sanity. And then I probably started writing when I was about 14 or 15, like a lot of people, you know, doing poetry and liking that. And then writing some songs.
So you still write songs and all of that?
Yeah, I write generally. I don't have a... songs are kind of like, I don't know, they're like kids or something. They come on their own time. You sit down and you work with them, and I'll write when I'm... I generally, honestly, write when I'm really upset. That's like, it's like a form of emotional survival, and it's like a problem-solving technique, actually, honestly. A lot of times if I'm jammed up emotionally or really upset, I can't figure out what to do, I kind of get cornered, and I sit down with my guitar and I write. And a lot of times a song offers, I find a lot of hope in songwriting. I'll sit down with a problem and I'll end up with a solution, you know, or at least a good song, which is great. If you're having a bad day and you get a good song out of it, it's like a lot better than just having a bad day. But when I say literally it's a survival tool, I mean that. I can't understand how other people cope with life. Who don't write. You know, it's an outlet. It's a form of solace.
So coming to Eco Village to do straw bale, what got you interested in that?
I totally believe in the fundamental importance of affordable housing. You know, if you lived in a tribe in Australia, for example, or anywhere that we consider primitive, which is just a distorted perspective on our part, anywhere that you would live like that, people have housing. It's a right. You know, everybody has a house. I mean, they don't have a 2,000-square-foot beautiful mansion with a Jaguar in the driveway, but everybody has a functional house that they own. That's my attraction to it. And also, they're incredibly beautiful. You know, they're simple and they're just beautiful. And one of my goals is to have my own house. So, but what I really want to do bigger than that is build my own house in New Jersey, but have it be a model for affordable, energy efficient housing in that area.
Meaning straw bale housing.
Well, I'm trying to be. I happen to have fallen in love completely with the straw bale model, the straw bale technology, because it's so beautiful and it's so cool. Because straw is a waste product, it actually causes trouble in a lot of areas where they have to burn it. So, and I also love the idea that you could have somebody growing your house for you, you know, like the farmer down the street. Like, what are you growing this year? Well, we've got some corn, we've got some potatoes, and we're growing three houses. So, but I'm trying to be open-minded too. I'm really in a learning process. I'm learning a lot about it. I'm going to look at some other things. And, I mean, straws where I'm drawn to, but I'm trying to be open-minded in case there's, you know, something that would actually work better or some combination like cob and straw. So, and to come to Eco Village in Ithaca, I mean, Ithaca is just like, what I love about Ithaca is that there's all this stuff that people dream about doing in other places that people actually are doing in Ithaca. And like, I come up here and get my batteries charged, you know, to go back home and say like, look, this is possible. People are doing it. You know, we're sitting here in the common house in Eco Village and, you know, it's as solid as anything. And they're proven, you know, they work. And, you know, the things that people want to laugh at initially, like, are they fire resistant? They're actually more fire resistant. Are they stable? They're actually more stable. What about insects? You know, they're actually, there's less problem done right. I mean, there's things you have to pay attention to, just like any project. But, you know, when people are going to laugh at you and say, you can't do it. Like, all their objections are, like, scientifically incorrect.
I went to the shoe store. They had so many shoes. I looked down to see if I had more than 2 feet. Nope. Remember Imelda Marcos? She never would have had that little shoe problem if there were way too many shoes to pick from in the first place. But I was looking for peace of mind. A little more time and more open space for this overcrowded human race. And I looked in every store, I went to another mall and I looked some more, but they didn't have it in my size. You go into any drugstore, anywhere, they have more than 100 things that you can put in your hair. You know, you can do more things with your hair than you can do with a consenting adult in the privacy of your bedroom. I think there's something wrong with that. I was looking for peace of mind. Open space for this overcrowded human race. And I looked in every store, I went to another mall and I looked some more, but they didn't have it in my size. Well, it's Saturday, I'm at the mall. It would be unpatriotic to leave without buying something and taking it home in a plastic bag. So what do I need? Job, this is it. I got enough to eat, got a place to live, I got 10 different shoes for 2 different feet. Seems like I'm set.
Do you have any other comments you'd like to make?
I guess one of the things I want to say about sustainable development and living like an environmentally sensitive and friendly life is that, first of all, it's a totally better quality of life, whether you actually believe in any of the reasoning behind it or not. Like, just, I mean, we're sitting here in this beautiful sun-drenched room right now, looking out over a beautiful water thing. I guess you call that a pond. With these beautiful plants and everything, it's just incredibly beautiful. But the other reason that we're doing this stuff is that so that the people that are coming up behind us have a place to live, you know? And it's just so beautiful to me to see the people coming up behind us, like, already putting their shoulders to the job, you know? And so it's just, I feel so blessed. I mean, I get to live this life where play music, interact with all different kinds of people of all different ages, do these socially positive things, you know, and eat well. So I'm blessed, and I really, really appreciate you spending some time with me.
Thank you.
For this overcrowded human race, and I looked in every store. I went to another mall, and I looked some more, but they didn't have it on my size. I'm from New Jersey. This song could be really long. Don't worry, we're getting there any minute. By this time, I was exhausted, so I went to Roy Rogers. I had a Dr. Pepper. I know I shouldn't have. It could have been that, though. Might have been the fluorescent lights, but I started thinking, you know, if we took down the malls, all these people would have a lot more time. I'd have some peace of mind. There'd be so much more open space. Hey, isn't that what I came here for in the first place? I jumped up, got everyone together. We went back to every single mall. We took out all our credit cards. We slapped them down, and we bought them all. And we took them down, one by one. Now we all have a lot more fun at the Lehigh Valley Wildlife Rescue. The Short Hills Bird Sanctuary.
That was Shopping Mall Redemption by Kathy Moser. Last Wednesday, April 2nd, Sandy Weil, chairman and CEO of Citigroup, spoke at Cornell University. Citigroup is the number one funder of fossil fuel extraction worldwide, and Weil has come under fire personally for trading stock ratings for favors. In response, the Rainforest Action Network and Cornell activists organized for a teach-in, protests, and debate. Brian Zemanski reports.
Word of Weil's receipt of Cornell's Hatfield lectureship infuriated some Cornell students, who organized for Randy Hayes, president of the Rainforest Action Network, to fly to Ithaca for the purpose of challenging Weil to a debate. Hayes spoke Tuesday night about corporations, social justice, resources, and the world economy.
In a general system, there are certain places where you can make a minor intervention and have major repercussions. The people who control the rule writing have major ramifications in the overall system. You know, a simpler analogy would be the White House. And now that 411 companies have signed a pledge to not use old growth wood and old growth paper, you know, a little group like Rainforest Action Network and grassroots groups like yourselves can team up and work together, and we can make major shifts in the systems, in this case, the wood products sector of the global economy. And I promise you, if we all throw our shoulders to the task, we can build that sustainable society in our lifetime. Now, the most important environmental policy in the United States, if you want to save your trees, is economic policy. If you take a coal-fired power plant, and that sulfur and CO2 and soot is being spewed out into society, say it's landing right here in Ithaca, the price people pay for the electricity they got from that power plant doesn't incorporate cost to your health from the pollution, right? So you have to internalize externalities.
In advance of Weil's speech, activists gathered outside Rockefeller Hall to protest. Weil, perhaps influenced by the protest, addressed globalization, conflicts such as the war in Iraq, and what he called corporate governance issues.
Sound financial systems facilitate the creation of new firms. They enable companies to become more efficient through mergers and acquisitions, both local and cross-border. Citigroup is in over 100 countries, but we are not seen as a threat to those cultures because more than 98% of the people that work for us in those countries are local to the country. Especially in light of our current rift with Europe and other tensions around the world, we need to work very hard to keep globalization on track. Just as economic growth is our best answer to global poverty, it is also one of our best answers to the problems in the Middle East and elsewhere in the world. The key to a lasting peace in the Middle East, in North Korea, is public policies and diplomatic efforts that support trade, education, and entrepreneurial activities. In addition to internal checks, there needs to be a rigorous external balance. Outside auditors should be used for audit-related and tax-related functions, period, not for consulting.
After Weil's speech, a question-and-answer session was held. Many of the anti-Citibank protesters came in to attend this portion of the program. Twice, protesters held up anti-Citi signs and were escorted out of Rockefeller Hall.
I wonder why Citigroup risks its image by providing capital for projects like the Camisea gas fields of Peru, because it was internationally recognized as a human rights and environmental crisis.
We did not provide capital to that project. We were an advisor, but I think that's why I was saying before that I think the important thing is that we get all of the financial institutions
to understand what is the right thing for the governments, for the people, what is the cleanest thing for the environment, and how can it best be done to create a better quality of life for everybody.
Why did you choose to decline your nomination to the New York Stock Exchange Board of Governors?
The New York Stock Exchange had approached me many, many times. We had a lot of these regulatory investigations, and I told Dick Grasso, who was the chairman of the Stock Exchange, that there could be a lot of feedback because of it, close to these issues, and that maybe this is not a good idea, and I'd like him to take my name out. And he said, trust me, I won't go ahead with this unless I think that everything is going to be fine. And he announced it on Friday. The Attorney General went a little ballistic, and Sunday night it appeared that the best thing was to decline. I watched what Henry Kissinger did, and I did it faster.
Despite the embarrassment they caused, Citigroup's detractors were by no means left with success. Weil largely ignored their criticisms about globalization with a joke and an obtuse reference to the invisible hand theory that states, in essence, that capitalism works in the public's best possible interest, which stood in sharp contrast to Hayes' claims about externalities such as pollution. But if Weil takes Hayes' propositions seriously, there is a potential for tremendous change. Citibank is the largest private financial institution in the world. And a serious debate with someone such as Randy Hayes, who is working for a sustainable future, would result in benefits on both sides.
Thanks to Brian Zemanski for that piece. With the overwhelming coverage of the war in Iraq, many people have forgotten New York State's traditional legislative struggle to pass a budget. This week, we resume our series of commentaries by former Assemblyman Marty Luster with his view on that struggle.
Every Tuesday about this time of year, the hallways in the Legislative Office Building in Albany are filled to overflowing with paid lobbyists, interest group representatives, and many, many just plain citizens. They are there to persuade, pressure, convince, and cajole members of the legislature to increase the appropriations for their special interests, whether it be schools, child care, health care, the environment, agriculture, or any of the other thousands of items that comprise the annual state budget. To any observer, this appears to be a good and exciting example of representative government at its best. However, unless the citizen is looking for a reduction in spending for his or her program, perhaps the best advice the legislator could render would be to give directions to the governor's office across the street in the Capitol, for that's where the budget power lies in the state of New York. But that has not always been the case. Although the state constitution seems to severely limit the power of the legislature to alter the governor's proposed budget to striking out or reducing proposed expenditures and to add new items, until relatively recently, a process of negotiation between the legislative leaders and the governor and a liberal interpretation of the limiting language of the constitution allowed for a productive, albeit clumsy, tardy, and awkward budget-making process. The rank-and-file legislators, through their leaders, acted as the voices of the public and brought their concerns to the negotiating table. The first sign of trouble was in 1993 when the Court of Appeals, New York's highest court, held that the language of the Constitution that appears to limit the authority of the legislature should be strictly construed. Specifically, the court prohibited the executive and legislative branches from even agreeing to change language in the governor's proposed spending bills, requiring instead that any such changes be contained in separate pieces of legislation. The court's holding was not a big deal and constituted more of a procedural nuisance than a seismic shift in constitutional theory. That was until Governor Pataki seized upon the decision to justify what is clearly an enormous power grab and an effort, thus far successful, to undermine the ability of the legislature to do its job. Let me explain. In 1998, the legislature convened joint bipartisan conference committees to negotiate the differences that existed between the Assembly's and Senate's responses to the governor's budget. An agreed-upon budget was passed by each House and was sent to the governor, who then line-item vetoed most of the increased appropriations agreed to by the legislature. This, although it was a meat-cleaver approach to budget-making, was clearly within his power. However, in addition, Pataki line-item vetoed new language, program descriptions and directions placed by the legislature in separate language bills as required by the 1993 decision, thereby altering and in many cases reversing the legislative intent. The Assembly sued, and the lower court has upheld the governor's actions. The second blow came in 2001 when the governor, relying on the constitutional provision that limits the legislature's actions on appropriation bills to striking or reducing appropriations, loaded up his appropriation bills with language that changed the purpose and intent of existing law. For example, one bill from the governor made dramatic changes in the school aid formula, changes that would have negative effects on many rural schools. To counter this, the legislature deleted Pataki's language changes, saying that any proposed changes in language of the law must be submitted separate and apart from appropriations, thereby giving the legislature the opportunity to accept, reject, or modify. The governor sued and was upheld by the lower court, despite the argument by the legislature that the governor's actions were void and that the legislature has a duty to strike void provisions. The combined effect of these decisions is that the governor may unilaterally change or create the law detailing budget expenditures, and the legislature is powerless to do anything about it, except, as one judge suggested, delay enactment to bring political pressure upon the governor. While all this may sound somewhat esoteric and theoretical, the final outcome of these issues are of the greatest importance to the people of New York. If the lower court decisions are ultimately upheld by the Court of Appeals, the legislature's role in the making of our budgets will be reduced to that of a rubber stamp for the governor. Then, absent a major constitutional overhaul, the hallways of the legislative office building will be empty, but so too will be our democracy. This is Marty Luster.
This Tuesday, April 8th, Maura Stevens will give a talk entitled What Sanctions Are Doing to the People of Iraq and answer questions about her recent peace and humanitarian mission to Iraq. That's tomorrow afternoon at 12:10 at Ithaca College in Clark Lounge. If you're interested in contributing stories to this program, the Ithaca Radio Hour is offering a workshop on editing audio on your home computer. That's this Thursday at 6 o'clock at Autumn Leaves on the Ithaca Commons. Everyone is welcome. For more information, call Jesse at 273-0532. Learn to help produce and host shows in WVBR's Youth Radio Workshop this summer. Contact Denise at 275-0021 or email Denise, that's D-E-N-I-C-E, at twcny.rr.com. Registration deadline is April 15th. Take Back the Night is an annual nationwide event to reject domestic violence and sexual assault. This Friday, march is departing at 5 p.m. from Ithaca College, Cornell University, and Washington Park will converge on the Ithaca Commons for a rally and speak out beginning at 5:30. Those concerned about the targeted detentions and deportations of Arabs and Muslims in the U.S., as well as those who want to learn the hard facts and consequences of recent legislation passed in the name of fighting terrorism, are encouraged to attend this Saturday's forum on homeland insecurity, domestic racism, and the attack on civil liberties. That's April 12th, from 10:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. in Kauffman Auditorium in Goldwyn Smith Hall on the Cornell campus. On April 15th, Kuzlar is sponsoring an evening of puppet theater and workshops with the Argentine Autonomous Project, a group of activists, students, puppeteers, and workers who use art as a means to shed light on issues of social justice and political change in Argentina. At 4:30 in Heck Auditorium at Goldwyn Smith Hall on the Cornell campus, there will be a lecture, and at 8 p.m. there will be a puppet performance in Annabelle Taylor Hall. This event is a part of a week of protest against exploitative and harmful U.S. policies toward Latin America. For more information, contact Kuzlar at cornell.edu or call 607-255-7293. This week's show was produced by Jesse Lind, Jeff Kirby, Brian Zamansky, and Lara Ratzlaff, with help this week from Emily Shumway. Our theme music is an instrumental version of Circus by Crow Greenspun. I'm your host, John Illingworth. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week.
The Ithaca Radio Hour is a project of Ithaca Community Radio and is produced at Rep Studio. For more information about ICR, visit our website at ithacaradio.org. You're listening to WEOS 89.7 Geneva, rebroadcast in Ithaca by Ithaca Community Radio on 88.1.